Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's on vacation. Veteran Congressman Charlie Rangel faces a September trial before the House Ethics Committee, the same month he has a primary. An Arizona sheriff launches an immigration sweep despite a federal court ruling against key provisions of that state's new immigration law. And the Army private accused of leaking classified material to the website WikiLeaks has been transferred from Kuwait to a military brig in Virginia. Joining me in the studio for the Friday News Roundup, David Korn of Mother Jones Magazine, The Washington Post's Karen Tumulty, and Stephen Hayes of The Weekly Standard. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org or find us on Twitter or Facebook. Well, you know, we thought that controversial Arizona immigration law was going to go into effect yesterday. Lots of reporters on the scenes, demonstrations. Something happened, though, Karen. What was it?
A judge happened named Susan Bolton, who put a temporary injunction on the enforcement of the key provisions of the law, the most controversial ones that that law enforcement would be required to check the immigration status of people who were stopped on other crimes, that immigrants would be required to carry papers, that immigrants, suspected illegal immigrants, could be arrested without warrants. And she said that she had put the temporary injunction on because she did not believe in the end that these provisions would be deemed constitutional. So what this has done is set into motion a process that is probably going to take this ultimately into the lap of the United States Supreme Court.
Now, this judge basically agreed with the Obama administration argument in this case. Any surprise, Steve, that this got, despite all the publicity, this ended up being delayed, blocked at least for now?
Well, I think there was some speculation that she was going to go the other way based on some questioning. But, you know, I think overall, people will say she's a Clinton appointee. She, you know,
although
she's
recommended
been praised
by John recommended
Kyle.
By John Kyle, a conservative Republican senator.
Conservative, but you know, if you talk to people on the Hill, they will say that that's more sort of pro forma. This is what you do. You say nice things about judges from your state. I don't think there is there was necessarily a ton of political surprise, but it certainly increased the level of anxiety, I think, among those who want to see the law passed and want to see further restrictions of illegal immigration.
Well, David, what's the impact in terms of trying to find a political solution instead of a legal, you know, one through the court system? Could this promote the idea that there'd be some federal action on immigration this year?
No. I mean, and you know all the reasons why. I mean, there's been, you know, the Obama administration did try to make an initiative to move ahead with a with legislation on a federal approach to immigration, and it's one of these things where everybody sort of knows what the grand deal is. You know, some form of path to citizenship for the 12 million or so people who are not here legally, and beefing up, you know, some of the protections at the border and better enforcement, and you know. Neither side, it seems, particularly, I think particularly the Republicans are rushing to make that deal. And it's become a political football that is just not going to rest comfortably before the election. And I doubt they'll be able to handle this in a lame duck session afterwards.
The more practical effect may be that this has put the brakes on the many, many other states that were attempting to implement similar laws for themselves.
What's the political impact if the court action is pending and there's no federal immigration law passed before the election? How big an issue do you think this will be, Steve, in the midterms?
Well, I answered that question elsewhere about a month ago, and I said I didn't think it would have much of an impact. I don't think people – I mean, we've seen in the past, over the past 15 years, people aren't necessarily motivated to go to the polls because of immigration. And it always – despite all of the buildup as a political issue, it rarely registers as the kind of political issue that people think, that I think we in the Washington media have long believed. I think I was wrong. I think it actually will have a much more significant impact this year than it has in the past, in part because you look at the number of states that want to do something like Arizona is doing, and while they can't move ahead legally, they certainly can move ahead rhetorically. And you saw this immediately after the ruling. I mean, I was getting press releases from the gubernatorial candidates in Wisconsin, you know, attorney generals in the West. I mean, everybody wants to have an opinion about this and wants to campaign on it, particularly Republicans.
You know, the interesting thing about immigration as a political issue is that it really is the matter, you know, where you stand is maybe where you sit, and so to speak. There are very clear regional differences. There are very clear differences in congressional districts. You know, I think, you know, Meg Whitman was worried in California running for the governor's seat there that if this ruling went into force and people started being rounded up in Arizona, it might actually motivate Latino voters more so in California to vote against Republican, because there is a whole history in California of that sort of politics. And so maybe this will give her a sigh of relief. The Democrats clearly were pushing for a grand piece of legislation early in the year, thinking that in many places that would help them. So, I mean, there are a lot of calculations that can be done, but clearly when you look at the, you know, what's driving the Republican Party now, the Tea Party passions, this is something that will probably further inflame those.
David Korn, he's Washington Bureau Chief of Mother Jones Magazine and blogs at politicsdaily.com. Well, you know, in the second hour of the news roundup, we're going to talk about the impact of this WikiLeaks story on the ground in Afghanistan. But let's talk a bit now in this first hour about some of the politics and the administration's reaction to the posting of all those documents from the Afghanistan war on the website WikiLeaks. Karen, what's the impact on the White House and their effort to build support for the course they've charted in Afghanistan?
Well, this comes against a context where they were already losing support. It was eroding away on Capitol Hill for this. I think there is actually, in terms of, I think what it does is reinforce the already growing perception that the effort there has not been going well. And I think that, you know, what we've seen, for instance, this week in the House vote on the funding, the additional supplemental funding for the war, twice as many Democrats voted against it. I think where it's going to see its effect is in both this December reassessment of the strategy and probably strengthening the hand of Vice President Biden and those who have been arguing that, yes, indeed, the troop withdrawals do have to begin next July as promised.
Now, in that war funding vote in the House, Republicans stood with President Obama in terms of approving billions of dollars of additional funds for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, they did. I think only 12 Republicans voted against him, if that's right. I guess I have a little different take. I think it's done two things, in effect. It may have made the soft support, to the extent that it exists in the Democratic Party for the war, soften a bit further. But what the other thing it did, and I think this was, you know, contrary to the wishes of this Julian Assange who put these documents out, is it also in some ways showed that this is a broader, more regional war. It's not just Afghanistan, and we saw this in the documents that appear to demonstrate the assistance of Pakistan's ISI to the insurgency, to the Taliban in Afghanistan. We also saw in several new documents further evidence. We've been hearing this from administration officials and particularly the uniformed military, but we saw in these documents further evidence that Iran has been playing a role in the insurgency. And I think what that does here is for people who have been, you know, going to work or doing their jobs, not paying attention to the every minute by minute progress of the war, they wake up and say, whoa, this might be bigger than we thought it was.
You know, David, go ahead.
I think one of the interesting things about this whole episode is, you know, there was so much you can find in 92,000 documents. You know, the Guardian, which was one of the three newspapers or two newspapers and a magazine that got advanced copies of this, did an amazing piece on civilian casualties that these reports show and how some of these terrible, horrific incidents were not fully investigated. But the Obama administration has a problem. At the heart of its Afghanistan policy is a contradiction. So every time we talk about this, this contradiction comes a little bit more onto the stage. And that is, they say we must win the war, because if we don't win this war, Al-Qaeda is going to take over Afghanistan and then plot new 9/11s against us. At the same time, they say, we won't stay forever. And we're going to start withdrawing some troops next July, because they know that no one in America, no American voter, really likes or wants a quagmire. But those two statements, if you think about them, are at odds with each other. If indeed that is a threat, if that threat is the real threat, and I would challenge that to a certain degree, then maybe you have to stay there forever. Maybe you have to do whatever it takes. But the president can't quite say that to a public that is already kind of skeptical about the war. So anytime he has to talk about Afghanistan in a serious manner because of a leak or because of McChrystal or anything else, he runs into this problem, and it's going to become more intense as they get to that review in December that you mentioned earlier.
And in an interview that Vice President Biden did with my colleague David Jackson this week, he was asked, if things go badly, will we extend our commitment in Afghanistan? And he said, I don't think so.
Well, then you go back to, you know, each side will be able to pick up quotes that have been said, you know, by Robert Gibbs or the president. And when they make these dire predictions about what would happen in Afghanistan if we weren't there, they're going to be played back in July 11th if we start pulling out.
Some people compared this to the Pentagon Papers case in 1971 that had a big effect on attitudes toward the Vietnam War. Just briefly, Karen, does this rise to that level, do you think?
You know, I don't quite see it. On the one hand, it's in far more close to being in real time than the Pentagon Papers were, but it really didn't demonstrate some kind of high-level systemic effort on the part of the government to mislead the American people.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about that case with Congressman Rangel. We'll take your calls and questions. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio, Stephen Hayes. He's a columnist for the Weekly Standard. Karen Tumulty, national political reporter at the Washington Post. And David Korn, Washington bureau chief at Mother Jones. Quite a scene yesterday as charges were unveiled against Charlie Rangel, one of the longest serving, once one of the most powerful members of Congress, until recently chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. David Korn, what is he charged with?
Well, there are 13 different charges in the indictment, and some of the major ones are that he didn't disclose all his financial assets on the financial disclosure forms, but also that he solicited contributions for a Charlie Rangel Center that he wanted to have built from people who had business before the committee, lobbyists and business interests. He also had a rent-controlled apartment in Manhattan that he might have violated the rules on that. What am I missing? There are a couple of other things, too.
He also didn't pay adequate taxes on a second home in the Caribbean,
Dominican Republic, right?
Yes, which is a particular embarrassment when you are the chairman of the committee that writes the tax law for the rest of us.
So kind of a surprise, I thought, that this has gone this far, that we may actually see a trial in September. What happened to the talks that we knew were going on behind the scenes?
Yeah, well, I don't know that we know exactly what happened to the talks, but they clearly weren't successful. I mean, the interesting thing is you have Charlie Rangel saying that he has eager to have this discussion in public, eager to be able finally to address the charges brought against them. And I would submit that he's probably the only Democrat in Washington who's eager to have this take place in public.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, Rod Blagojevich said he was eager to testify, and that didn't happen either. I mean, my understanding is, I mean, this is a bipartisan panel made up of Republicans and Democrats. And so I think Republicans, to some degree, have to sign off on any settlement. And so there were these 11th hour settlement talks, and you know, I'm not sure who was giving, and we'll probably get a story on this in the next day or two, and who was, you know, holding firm. But it could well be that if Republicans see it advantageous to them politically to have this trial go ahead, which I think we agree it would be, that they may be playing really hardball with Charlie Rangel and making it difficult to reach a settlement. Then again, he might just be obstinate and not want to admit too much in terms of wrongdoing.
You know, though, I must say, you know, being on the ethics committee in the House is one of the least sought after assignments. Nobody wants to do it. And I do think that, you know, these are members dealing with members. And maybe it's naive to believe that anything isn't driven by partisan politics these days. But I do think the ethics committee does operate with a different ethic, perhaps, than other committees.
Well, one of the stories that I heard yesterday was that there was part of the hang-up was that they wanted him to acknowledge some culpability in what David was talking about with respect to this quid pro quo money for the Charlie Rangel Center on politics. And he was unwilling to do so, in part perhaps because of pride, but also in part because that could put him in further legal jeopardy if he acknowledged basically this kind
of
trade-off.
In terms of violating a federal statute as opposed to a congressional ethics rule.
Now, Karen and I were at a breakfast this week with two Democratic members of Congress who insisted this was no issue. This was of no concern to them. Americans were concerned about jobs. So the trial of this one Democratic member of Congress would have no effect on the midterms. Stephen, do you think that's right, or could this be one of those things that hurts Democrats in a tough year?
Of course it does. Of course. You never want to have somebody who for years ran the top tax writing committee have ethical and tax issues. It's perhaps the worst thing. And particularly in a time, in a political mood across the country where, you know, anti-Washington is in. It's anti-big business, sure, but it's also anti-Washington. And I think it's more specific than anti-Washington. I think it's anti-big government, anti-Washington, to a certain extent anti-Democrat, rather than just anti-incumbent.
David?
Well, I think one thing it will do, I don't think there are probably too many American voters out there who are going to follow this and care that much about this particular case. But I do think it will take up a lot of oxygen, you know, and you know, the Democrats have a lot to do if they want to preserve their majority in the House between now and November. And, you know, the economy is teetering. We got some disappointing economic news this morning. And so really what they need is a clear shot to say again and again and again, here's our case, here's what we're doing, here are bills we've passed, bills we've trying to pass, and here's what the Republicans are not doing, here's how they're blocking us in the small business credits or whatever. And anytime they have a sideshow like this, then it will be a very entertaining sideshow and it deserves attention. It will get in the way of that clear message, and that will rebound to the benefit of those who are trying to capitalize on the sentiments that Steve just described.
The disappointing news that David just mentioned is report out this morning that the recovery lost some momentum in the second quarter of the year. Growth slowed to 2.4%, its most sluggish showing in nearly a year, and 2 week to drive down those important unemployment numbers. We're going to go to the phones shortly. You can give us a call, 1-800-433-8850. What we're talking about campaigns, Karen, the campaign finance bill that we've heard so much about in the wake of that Supreme Court decision faltered in the Senate. Is it dead?
Harry Reid is insisting he is going to attempt to bring it back after the congressional recess. This was a campaign bill based, it was an answer to the Supreme Court decision that opened up corporate spend. It got rid of the limits on corporate spending in campaigns. Everyone, I think, on both sides is expecting an absolute flood as a result of this kind of spending. Their efforts to kind of not overturn the Supreme Court decision, but at least put some more disclosure into it so that if a company did spend a lot of money on a campaign ad, you would know who they were. It failed by a few votes. It came pretty close. What I think is the case is that they're, even if they can get this thing passed after Labor Day, it's not going to be in time to affect this election. So I think the floodgates are, in fact, open.
This law would have required chief executives to appear at the end of political ads they were funding, and it would have banned foreign corporations and governments from spending money in U.S. elections. So why, Steve Hayes, were Republicans so opposed to it?
Well, I think that they, you know, I think there are political considerations and substantive considerations. I think on the political side, you know, Republicans thought it was advantageous to, you know, open this new flood of money. On the substantive side, I think Republicans would be in favor of more disclosure. And this has been a Republican talking point on campaign finance going back forever. If it were accompanied by a more dramatic reworking of campaign finance laws generally. And I think that is the sort of the heart of the opposition.
Let's go to the phones and let some of our listeners join this conversation. We'll start with Melissa. She's calling us from Baltimore. Melissa, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I had a comment about the Charlie Rangel situation and it potentially being advantageous to the Democrats who have, you know, screamed and yelled about the partisanship in politics, and their opportunity here to really come down hard on someone who has broken the law in sort of opposition to what happened with Scooter Libby and the Republicans. I think this is a great opportunity for the Democrats to say, hey, we'll go after our own if it's deserved, and really put a good face on for their voters.
All right, Melissa, thanks for your call. Karen, how have Democratic leaders responded so far? Have they come down hard on Rangel, as Melissa suggests they might want to do?
Well, they have certainly given him some time to try to negotiate an arrangement and some kind of deal. But Melissa is absolutely right. And Nancy Pelosi in particular is in a difficult spot on this, because when the Democrats took over the House in the 2006 elections, one of the most well-remembered phrases was Nancy Pelosi's promise to, quote unquote, drain the swamp. So this is a real kind of put up or shut up moment, I think, for the Democrats.
We've got two emails that take very different views of that Arizona immigration law. The first one, which comes from Arizona, says, quote, the Jews in Germany were required to wear yellow stars on their clothes. That was my first thought when I heard about Arizona requiring legal immigrants to carry their papers at all times. And then we have a different email from Joy saying, when I travel abroad, I must carry my passport. If I keep my actual passport in my lockbox, I have a copy with my identification. The Arizona law at minimum brings Arizona up to par with other nation states. So what do you make of these two very different perspectives?
Well, for those of us, you know, on the right with a sort of strong libertarian impulse, you know, you don't like the idea of having to carry papers. But certainly the first email is, I think, vastly overstating the problem. And it is the case that in Mexico, you have to carry papers. Throughout Europe, you have to carry papers. This is not something that would be, you know, unique to the United States. It's, in fact, something that happens all around the world.
Well, you know, a lot of people on the right and the left have agreed that we shouldn't have citizen cards and things like that we have to carry throughout the country. And a lot of those policies are overseas or federal policies. You know, I've spoken to some law enforcement people down there, and, you know, it's pretty much the consensus, you know, I won't put a number on it, 90% or so, that in the law enforcement community, that the law was a bad deal, that it would, you know, would make things worse in terms of dealing with crime, whether it's committed by illegal immigrants or not. And, you know, they are the police chiefs, except for a few notable ones, and sheriffs are pretty, you know, satisfied with the court ruling. They do not think this is good policy. They do not think it will protect the citizens there of Arizona, where indeed crime and illegal immigration has gone down in the last year rather than gone up.
Now, the Obama administration's objections, though, and the reason that the law has been blocked is not because of the debate over whether it's good policy or offensive policy to require people to carry identification. It's really over who's in charge of immigration.
Right. This is their legal argument is essentially that the state is trying to usurp the federal government, which powers, and that the federal government really is the authority that is charged with enforcing the borders.
We have a comment on Facebook from Stacy, who says, The Arizona immigration law, I'm having a hard time understanding why our state is being sued by the federal government over it and why anyone has a problem with states having a law that reinforces an already existing federal law.
Well, and I think this is the sort of common sense position that you see that goes beyond just the right. I mean, this is why I think polls show overwhelmingly that the law is supported in Arizona and around the country, because there is a sort of, you know, sort of are you serious component to this. Like, the federal government isn't doing its job or not doing it as effectively as it should be. The state wants to make sure that the federal government does its job better and so passes a law to help in that effort. And the federal government says basically, in effect, no, you can't help us do our job even though we're not doing it as well as we should be.
Stephen Hayes, he's a columnist for the Weekly Standard. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your questions, 1-800-433-8850. Well, there was a bill to increase small business lending up this week. Didn't get very far, David.
Well, 59 votes, which is a majority. It got, you know, almost a supermajority in some. This is, you know, where we see what's happening in Washington, where the Republicans, you know, threaten, which is the same thing as basically as conducting a filibuster. There were 59 votes in favor of this bill, which would set up $30 billion in sort of a fund for credit for small banks to give credit to small businesses. And the Republicans say that they more or less are in principle in agreement with this program, but they want other things added to the bill. Yes, you know, getting rid of estate taxes and other things that aren't necessary germane to this one program. So they have held it up. And also, I think, quite honestly, they do not want to see the Democrats have a political success at this point in time. So rather than say, let's have a fight about these other matters on another day and let's pass what we can to benefit, you know, the American public if we agree this is a good program, they have thrown a monkey wrench into the works on an issue that probably doesn't warrant a filibuster.
Well, Karen, do you agree with that? And if you do, doesn't that mean that nothing else is going to get done before the election?
Well, the Republicans are arguing that it would have been passed if the Democrats hadn't kept turning to other issues. But I do think that if there's anything we should have learned from the health care debate is that once you start arguing about process, you're losing. And so I do think that given the emphasis and the exposure that the White House is giving this issue, their sense at least is that this is rapidly turning into a loser for the Republicans.
Well, Stephen, it is true that we hear a lot from small business owners about the terrible time they're having getting credit that enables them to keep their businesses going.
It's true. I think one of the other things Republicans want to do is force a bigger debate on what they think is going to be a policy that would have much greater impact, which is extending all of the Bush tax cuts. And I think the argument is a fairly simple one. Why take these sort of minor measures to help small businesses, even if, and I think David's right, Republicans basically agree that they would be helpful. You have business interest groups, Chamber of Commerce, NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business, that also say these things would be helpful. But why do these sort of micro programs? Why set up a $30 billion fund to enable small businesses and to get loans when you could actually just cut their taxes?
Oh, wait a second.
And you could cut their taxes and actually give them their own money back to use. I mean, now the way it is now, it's like you're creating these new loan programs so that small businesses can take the money and pay additional taxes. Doesn't make sense.
Steve, the reason to do it is if this is something that both sides agree on, then that's great. I mean, if you obviously they don't agree on tax cuts, they don't believe on the impact or the consequences of the tax cuts. There's an ideological policy divide there. So if you can't agree on that, but you can agree on something that's smaller that will help some people, then why not go ahead and do that? And why hold it up to have this other argument that you know will not lead to any policies or any resolution?
I think it's far from clear that it won't lead to any policies or any resolution. I think that Republicans, in fact, hope that it will and think that there will be a big debate come September about precisely those issues, and they're peeling off Democrats.
They could pass this now and have that debate in September.
There is a lot of talk in town about the extension of the Bush tax cuts, which expire at the end of the year. Karen, what do you think the prospects are that that gets resolved before the midterms? Or is that one of those issues that gets pushed to a lame duck session?
Well, this is, I mean, Steve says, I think there is going to be a big debate over that issue no matter what in September. So, you know, insisting that because this bill is out there, this is the time to have the debate is one of the reasons I think that this is a loser for the Republicans. In the Senate, Harry Reid's office is saying they do intend to get this done before they leave for the year, that this is not a lame duck issue. Other people are somewhat more skeptical.
Well, now you said, Karen, earlier that this small business package going down was politically bad for Republicans. Are Democrats uncomfortable with arguing that they don't want to extend all the Bush tax cuts?
Some Democrats are, and here's why. There are a couple of arguments that you're hearing more from conservative Democrats. One is that extending it only to people who make below $250,000, which has been the president's policy, would catch a lot of small businesses, people who, I think, file their taxes, for instance, under subchapter S. And another reason is that wealthier people spend more. And if what you're looking for is economic stimulus, one of the things we saw in these new economic numbers is people are saving rather than spending. This would go to people who spend.
Karen Tumulty, she's national political reporter at The Washington Post. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to go straight to the phones and take some of your calls and questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Progressive Insurance, sponsor of the Automotive XPRIZE competition to develop vehicles that exceed 100 MPGE, progressiveautoxprize.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, whose Kids Count is a state-by-state look at child well-being and the important role of data at aecf.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. The Obama administration reacts to the WikiLeaks revelations. South Korea and the U.S. wrap up 4 days of war games. And a report reveals how reconstruction funds for Iraq have been spent. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We're going to go to the phones and take some of your calls and questions. 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to Barbara. She's calling us from Medford, Oregon. Barbara, thanks for holding on.
Oh, good morning. I have a question about the economic recovery. Since we are a consumer-driven economy that overspent and overextended our credit, we lived beyond our means, I'd like to ask the panel, what do they see as an economic recovery? I mean, we can't go back to the lifestyle and the ways we were spending like there was no tomorrow, which kind of brought on this economic disaster. So, I mean, how do we redefine an economic recovery these days?
And Barbara, let me ask you, how about you? Do you think this very modest recovery we're in now, does that feel like a recovery to you?
As long as we're not losing jobs the way we were, and as long as I feel comfortable going to the store and, you know, and buying extra things beyond groceries, I do see hope. I do see light at the end of the tunnel, but I also think that we also need to stand back and redefine what we all think is a modest lifestyle and reasonable spending.
Mm-hmm. Well, Barbara, thanks for your call. Let me ask the panel, do you think that these kind of American expectations are being reset by this recession?
Well, I think perforce for some, they have been. If you can't get a subprime loan and put $7,000 down on a $700,000 house and, you know, live in it for a few years, and you have to come up with other plans. But, you know, the essence of her question is there does seem to be a contradiction in the American economic formula, which is if we're consumer driven, people have to get out and spend. The question is, what is generating the wealth that we are spending to keep the economy going? And in years past, we could point to various industries, and we had, you know, even .com before it became a bubble that burst. And so the issue is, as the world becomes more globalized and competition goes up, where's our advantage in terms of wealth creation? And Obama, with the stimulus bill, has talked about trying to, you know, get some certain sectors going and ginning them up. But we don't have an industrial policy in this country the way other nations do, and I think we've suffered for that.
Now, we've gotten several emails in response to something Karen said. This one's from Madeline, who's a small business owner in Maryland. And she writes, one of your guests just said that wealthy people spend more. I'd like to hear some follow-up to that. It is my understanding that, in fact, the opposite is true. If you give a poor man a dollar, we will most certainly spend it because he cannot afford to save. But if you give it to Warren Buffett, it will probably go into the bank.
Well, I guess what I was thinking of was not, you know, sort of the necessities of life, but the kind of consumer spending that people are talking about that would, in fact, give, again, what economists would argue is energy to the recovery. And I would point out that in the latest economic figures, Americans are actually saving more, that they saved 6.2% of their income in the second quarter, which is the highest share in a year. So, again, while you could certainly argue it is poor people who have to spend a larger share of their income on things like groceries and their mortgage payments, if you look at the percentage of consumer spending that is done overall in this country, it's the wealthy do a disproportionate share of it.
Steve.
Yeah, I think they're both right. I think that's exactly what it is. When you have the wealthy, the people in this top tax bracket, that's going to be the center of the debate in September over the extending the Bush tax cuts, spending roughly 30% of overall consumer spending, that is what Republicans are going to argue will help stimulate the economy, is to flush that money back into the economy.
And here's an email from Ernie, who writes us from Seattle. He says, the Senate has become an anchor around the neck of America, the place where legislation goes to die. Can one of your guests explain why the Democratic leadership doesn't call the bluff of the Republican senators and force them to actually do a filibuster, read a phone book, poetry on the floor of the Senate while the government grinds to a halt? It would make pretty good TV, wouldn't it, David?
I'm not sure how great TV that would be to watch Senator John Kyle reading poetry for 22 hours. Not to pick on him, but just to pick a Republican at random. There is a move afoot by some Senate Democrats toward filibuster reform. And a lot of this is due to, you know, secret holds and all sorts of manipulation of the rules that allows, you know, members to clog things up without actually having to go to the well and read the phone book the way that Jimmy Stewart once did many, many decades ago.
He was not actually a senator. You know that, right?
But, well, no, that was... Yeah.
But that's why Ernie has such a great idea, in my opinion. I mean, just make them do it. And that requires, by the way, discipline on the part of the majority side.
Yes.
That the Democrats would actually have to keep 51 of their own members on the floor at all time. And they would have to say, sorry, guys, no fundraisers tonight. And I think the last time we saw something like this actually happen was over a campaign finance bill in the late 1980s when Robert Byrd, then the majority leader, actually sent the sergeant at arms out, and they were literally physically dragging senators back to the Senate floor.
I think they would have to pick their issues very carefully. I mean, one of the things that we've seen happen in the first 18 months of the Obama administration is public attitudes about Obama administration policies and the way that politics are going in the country has shifted. And to a certain extent, if this is one of the things that puzzles me about the campaign arguments that the president is making right now. He's constantly talking about Republicans blocking his agenda. And in fact, Republicans haven't actually blocked much of his agenda. But to the extent that they are trying to block his agenda, they're more in step at this point with where the American public is than the Democrats.
I don't think if you ask the people about the small business program or about even the you know, disclosing the names of big corporations and unions that fund ads, that those are minority positions. I assume you'll get somewhere between 70% and 90% approval for these things. So in that sense, there you can make the argument that on these issues at the moment, they are thwarting the will of not just the majority of the Senate, but maybe the majority of American people.
You know, we talked about some things that are not getting done or that got blocked in Congress this week, but something did pass, and that was a bill to reduce the disparity between sentences for crack cocaine and powder cocaine. This breezed through, Karen. Why did it have an easy going?
Well, it didn't breeze through. In fact, there was a lot of negotiation that was done in advance, and certainly it reduced the disparity. The disparity comes about going back to the 1980s when crack first appeared on the scene and became something of an epidemic. And I think the fact that it reduced the disparity but didn't eliminate it, it reflects both the politics of it and also the growing understanding, I think, that people in both parties have of the fact that there is some inequity and racially based inequity in how these sentences are handed out.
Stephen?
If you're going to have drug laws, you should have them apply equally, I think. So this is long overdue. This has been an issue for, as Karen says, since the 1980s. And there's been a push, and I think you've finally found some Republicans who have basically said, look, you can't give us a substantive reason for the disparity. Let's eliminate it.
Let's talk to Willow. She's calling us from Jamesport, which is on Long Island in New York. Willow, thank you for being with us.
Good morning. I have to tell you that at times I feel as though I'm Alice in Wonderland at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. And the reason I say that is if Charlie Rangel or any other congressionally elected official, if there's malfeasance and it's proven, why in the world are the commentators constantly, and it's not only on your show this morning, but it's on all of the media, constantly saying that there's a political aspect to it. If something, it's an egregious error. One of your commentators said this morning that the American people really don't care about this. And I'm a liberal Democrat, PhD educated, and I think that regardless of your background or your education, people do care. And I think people are absolutely fed up with the fact that there are certain rules that we must live by, and we abide by them. And then we say that someone like Charlie Rangel or anyone else should just do whatever they want, and then there's impunity. And I think it's absolutely it's outrageous to think that the American people are just going to stand by and have these congressionally elected officials act as though they're royalty. And he's not the only one. I mean, the New York Times had an editorial about this last year that he should, be indicted or investigated.
Right. Well, Willa, thanks for your call. David?
I don't think that Americans don't care. My guess is that if you're worried about the economy and still about health care and other matters, the education of your children, for a lot of people, maybe particularly outside the New York region too, where Rangel's a congressman, this is not a top drawer concern for them. But that's not to say that people like him should be allowed to get off. I mean, I think, as one caller mentioned earlier, it is rather commendable that the Democrats, with Republicans, are moving ahead to try him on what seems to be a very serious set of allegations. The one thing that Charlie Rangel said yesterday the day before that was interesting, was he said, well, at least they're not accusing me of corruption, meaning that he didn't, do anything for anybody. He didn't, rig any bills and, which would be even more egregious. But as it stands now, he's been indicted. We don't know what he's, you know, if these charges will be proven. There was a 32-page response his lawyers produced yesterday. You can find it online rather easily. And I think this is going to go ahead unless the Democrats succeed in doing what they want to do, pressure him into a settlement between now and September. There's still a lot of opportunity to do that.
I would take a bet that there'll be a settlement before there'll be a trial.
I think that you may be right about that. But I don't agree that he is necessarily being, you know, the Democrats are standing up and handling him so roughly. I mean, you know, when have we heard about Nancy Pelosi and others going to him and saying, look, this is despicable. These reports have been in the New York Times for better part of 2 years. The evidence is overwhelming. You know, you now have these 13 counts. Get out of Congress. You haven't heard that because they don't want to do that. They want, you know, people like Charlie Rangel. And I think this is one of the,
well, those
the things that goes.
Those conversations usually happen first in private. And then, you know, we'll see. It'll be interesting. Susan's bet is that there will be a settlement. You know, that may well come true. My bet is, as we get closer to there not being a settlement or one being agreed, you'll hear more voices of the sort
but you
that
haven't,
you just described.
But I think the caller's point is,
they took him out of his chairmanship. They stripped him of that. Yeah. And they, you know, and he has, you know, the real issue is the Ethics Committee, which has been, you know, a disaster on both sides of the Capitol Hill for years, took too long to deal with this.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Broken Bow, Oklahoma, which is a great name for a place, and talk to DJ. DJ, hi.
Hey. I had a comment and a question about the ruling in Arizona over the illegal immigrants carrying their papers. Most states that I know of, that I've been in and lived in, have laws on the books that says you have to carry and produce a state ID, a state-issued ID for legitimate reasons. If I'm walking down the street and a cop sees me and he says, hey, he looks like a guy that's been wanted for this crime, so I'm going to go ask him for his ID, make sure he ain't him. I have to produce an ID. Otherwise, if I don't, I could be charged criminally for that.
You know, DJ, that's interesting. I don't know the answer to whether that's true, that in most places you do are required to carry identification. Does anyone on the panel know? I think we look a little confused. here's another email that goes to the immigration debate. It's from Rick, who's writing us from Virginia Beach, Virginia. He says that we're all missing the point. He said the question is not about illegal aliens, it's about which subset of American citizens must be able to prove citizenship on demand. White people aren't going to be detained or jailed until they prove they're citizens, only Mexican-American citizens. Stephen, what would you say to Rick?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons that there was the initial concern when the Arizona law was unveiled. And one of the things that the author of the Arizona law, Chris Kobach, did to insert provisions that would explicitly rule out racial profiling. Now, whether that happens in practice, I don't know, but certainly the law itself has now made explicit that that is not to take place.
But the standards still are rather weak. You know, there's a requirement that if you suspect someone is illegal, that you, if you're a law enforcement official, you must ask. But what are the standards? What suspect in what way? And there seems to be a lot of discretion open. That actually, that's one of the concerns of the police officers, because they can be penalized for being in violation. So do they then have to be overly suspicious to make sure they don't get, you know, hit themselves?
Karen, this week we found out that BP was replacing CEO Tony Hayward, who'd had a lot of trouble with his public statements since that oil spill. He's being replaced by American Robert Dudley. Why are they making this change?
Well, I'm sure they wanted to see Mr. Hayward get his life back. As he had expressed the desire to. No, I'm being facetious, obviously. Tony Hayward was a public relations disaster, and it seemed like every time he opened up his mouth, he was creating more and more problems for the company. So it's interesting that they have replaced him with Bob Dudley, who not only had become the public face of the disaster, but also is the first American ever to run a company that has an increasing share of its business in revolving in the United States. And also, he is someone who has very deep roots in the Gulf region. He was actually raised in Hattiesburg, Mississippi.
And we've seen him on the TV a lot trying to make BP's case. There's some good news, it seems, out of the Gulf, Stephen, which is this oil. It seems to be dispersing much more quickly than we thought it was going to.
Yeah, very interesting reporting in Karen's paper yesterday and from Times' Michael Grunwald about this so-called missing oil. And when you look at the amount that is missing that they can't find, it's rather staggering and hopefully encouraging.
Now, we were puzzling over whether most states require you to produce an identification card. One of the producers for the Diane Rehm Show reports that with a quick search, there seems to be no compulsory national identity cards issued by the U.S. government. Legislative attempts to create ones have already failed. The only national identity card is the passport card and is issued to its citizens upon voluntary application. Of course, that doesn't get to the point, I don't think, of whether some states might, in fact, have their own rules. Well, that'll be the subject for another Diane Rehm Show. I want to thank our panel for being with us for this one. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm, who's on vacation. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.